This is the 1992 National Radio Club Convention Tape Series, and this is tape number 3.
Well, I certainly want to thank you all for coming here so early this morning. And Ernie, thank you very much for inviting me, and to you, Mr. Chairman, and Ken in particular, for confirming this. For inviting me here to give this presentation today. My wife and I are enjoying ourselves thoroughly, and it's important, it seems to me, that we all understand the new AM broadcasting rules as specified by the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, because these new rules I'm going to talk about are already in effect, and they will be changing a little about what you hear on the radio, and so it'll be fun to know what they are and why you're hearing some of the changes. But, you know, it's also interesting that a lot of the station owners are simply not familiar with them. In fact, the new regulations were announced just a year ago, October 1991, and they went into effect this last April 19th, if memory serves me right, 1992. And one of the broadcasting magazines this summer surveyed station owners about the new rules and found the most common response was, oh yeah, they knew all about the new rules, but really, no, hadn't had a chance to study them. And Washington-based lawyers and spectrum managers have tried in vain to call these new opportunities to the attention of station managers, but it appears with little impact, so who knows? Of course, you know, it may be that the amounts that some radio stations are now being fined by the FCC will cause a few owners to sit up and say, you know, what is this here? For instance, you know, the fines for airing parts of the Howard Stern Show, that morning wake-up program? Some of you have heard that, I'm sure. New York, Philly, Washington, Los Angeles. He's on there in the mornings now. The fines for some of the stuff he's put on the air are in the $100,000 range for each offense. And by the way, offensive it is, let me assure you. And you know, that's enough to catch the attention of even the big boys. And the new rules are riddled with lots of new watchdog items. A couple come to mind. Failure to give a proper legal station identification at the proper time. The fine for that is $2,500 for each offense. If you know, if you get caught and if you do it repeatedly. The FCC has a history of saying, hey, look, you're a bad boy, don't do it again. And then, and if you write an apologetic letter, they let it go. But if you ignore the FCC, that's the worst thing you can do if they ever confront you with anything. Don't let that happen. Oh, and another one of their dandy little fines is for having a tower unlighted without your telling the FAA. That's very serious because of airplane hazard, of course. $20,000 if a station in Georgia, an FM station, is being fined that just about as we speak. So there's lots of fun for those of us who are vaguely uncomfortable about some of the things we hear or know about the broadcast airwaves. But there are new opportunities that are interesting, too. They fall into the category of technical changes, and therefore they're not terribly easy to bring to the attention of non-technical station managers, of course, until it's too late. But just to give you an example of how things can sneak past somebody that doesn't have a technical background or so, if you go back to the early 1920s, I'm giving you this example so it won't offend too many in the room. Well, a couple of us maybe, but not really. You may not recall that once the Department of Commerce became convinced that a large number of frequencies, you know, might be required for this new broadcasting thing. They allocated an entire band of frequencies from 200 meters to 545, approximately, meters, allocated for broadcasting. It was on a shared basis with some government stations that had been on the air for many years. But the move was get the government stations to move to some other frequency and let the broadcasters have it. The problem, of course, was that the broadcast transmitters at the beginning were not very stable, and so they were kind of all over the dial anyway, as, you know, you had to track them with your receiver at home. But that was the way it went. And that band of meters, and they all used wavelength because of, for some other more serious technical reasons, would equate today to the band from 1,500 kilocycles, okay, down to 500 kilocycles or so. In fact, the band was even bigger than that, but then they got into trouble with some emergency ship broadcasts or transmissions. So anyway, 550 to 1,500, whereas today it's 550 to 1,600. I guess we're all together. Okay. It ended at 1,500. That's the thing. And then came along the late 1930s. The FCC announced that They were thinking of expanding the band above 1,500 kilocycles, and they opened three experimental channels above 1,500, between there and 1,600, in fact. And they said if anybody was interested, they could apply and for an experimental broadcasting license. Well, there were several companies and people who did apply, and in particular, there was one company in New York City that decided it was a pretty good idea, and they applied and were assigned the experimental call sign 2XR. And their tests went on for several years, finally getting up as high as 50,000 watts in power on an experimental basis at those frequencies, which, of course, is the maximum power permitted for any AM broadcaster in the United States. And the FCC watched these tests and agreed they were very successful, and so the commission decided it would extend the broadcast band above 1,500, another 10 channels, up to 1,600 on the dial, 1,600 kilocycles. The non-technical manager, if you will, in New York had some excellent briefing. That's why they went experimental in the first place. And station 2XR, by the way, by then their calls had all been conformed to the new FCC way of going. It was with a W and a K's, and the W call sign then was W2XR. When the day came to open the new frequencies officially, the New York Times, the owners of this experimental station, were allowed to change the numeral 2 to the letter Q, and that's how we come up with the call sign WQXR. One of the most prestigious set of call letters in New York today, and I say that with a tear in my eye because possibly between now and the end of the year, there are going to be some major changes in radio in New York City, and it may be that WQXR will actually change its call letters on the AM side, at least, and even change away from classical music, which any of you in the New York area know that's what they do. Incidentally, as a sidebar, this expansion of the broadcast spectrum also meant that the call letters of the CBS station in Washington, D.C., kind of lost their meaning. It had been broadcasting at the highest, the topmost frequency on the whole dial, 1,500. And so they used the call letters WTOP for the top. But, of course, once the band was extended to 1,600, that was no longer the case. And now you wonder, well, why is WTOP? Why do they have those call letters? Why don't they have WNEW or something if New York is, the rumors are right, are going to change their call letters? Because WTOP is all news all the time. Well, anyway, these are relatively minor examples of how the winds of change can blow over you unless you understand them and apply in time for the benefits of your own station. Because if 2XR under the New York Times leadership hadn't been started, there's a good question as to whether the New York Times would have had WQXR at all over these many years. And so what can we say? You know, it's important to realize one other thing about everything that we're talking about this morning, and that is that the new rules apply only to AM broadcasting. FM has not changed in any way according to these rules. Now, the reason that only AM is affected is that the FCC has decided that only AM needs to be saved from utter extinction at this time, probably. FM, with its 70% and growing share of the radio listening marketplace, appears to be doing okay without any further government intervention at this time. At least that's the way the FCC sees it. The FCC also has made a lengthy study, as a matter of fact, it goes back 2 or 3 years, to see why the profits of AM stations were diminishing. They knew that from their annual reports they get. But the results of the study indicated from a study commission, a Blue Ribbon group, a real good group of guys, by the way, found that AM was losing out to FM broadcasting because AM didn't sound as good as FM. And, I agree with you. I don't know how much money they spent on that, but they could have saved a lot of time and money if they'd come to us, right? Well, anyway, the FCC determined that the primary problem centered on interference that was being caused by one station on the AM dial to another station on the AM dial. In other words, the AM stations were their own worst enemy. They also noted that electrical interferences contributed to AM's woes, of course, in electrical static and in lightning storms and things, but they couldn't do much about that. But at least they didn't think so. Turns out maybe they could. But anyway, finally, the receiver manufacturers were building just poor AM radios. The bandwidth in the radio parts of the AM radios were so narrow that, over half the portable radios on the market today have less bandwidth in their AM sections than does your home telephone. It's really bad, is what we're saying. Whereas the FM is nice and broad and clean and crispy, right? Well, anyway, the FCC set out to fix what they could. So, what do you say? Let's take a look at how what the FCC has now ordered. In other words, what the new rules are. And I can only let you use your own imaginations as to how it might apply here in this area of the country or to where you live, any specific station located anywhere in the United States. The first thing the FCC has done is to use a new glossary of terms, which may make you shudder, since much of what the FCC does is reported in the vernacular of the spectrum manager anyway. But I'll give them this. At least this time they have switched back to the language of the International Telecommunications Union, which is the ITU. That's the international FCC, if you will, but international arm. It's an arm of the United Nations. They're based in Geneva, Switzerland. And if any of you can attend the second seminar this morning, we're going to talk a little more about the ITU and how it's arranged and what it does and for us and to us and all that good stuff. So the FCC has grouped its new AM stations into two categories. They've used terms, and these are not ITU terms, but we'll get to those in a second. The new terms for stations in two groups are Model 1 stations and Model 2 stations. Now, Model 1 stations are totally new radio broadcasting stations that will be assigned to frequencies starting at 1610 kHz and extending up to 1700 kHz. That's 10 new channels for AM broadcasting stations. These Model 1 stations will transmit with 10,000 watts during the daytime hours and 1,000 watts at night. They're going to be none of this critical hour powers and limited time things. As a matter of fact, they're going to be non-directional, and there will be no daytime-only stations whatsoever. 10,000 watts in the day, 1,000 watts at night, non-directional. That's very simple. Now, the Model 2 stations are those that we've been familiar with for the years. Some of the new rules may take you a little by surprise. The theme of the Commission's new regulations is to weed out the stations that are financially weak and let those with the greater resources survive. Now, they aren't going to do anything too drastic, but the goal here is quite noble. It's to strengthen the public interest service of AM radio, and the best way to do that is to let the better stations provide the information, the education, and entertainment that the public wants and deserves. So the FCC is now actively encouraging stations to find out what stations are interfering with their broadcasts, and wherever possible, to buy those interfering stations and to put them off the air. Now, okay, that's a little drastic. I know, I share the raised eyebrows. But just consider, this has already been done once on Long Island. One of the New York City stations, operating at 1280 on the dial, bought out a station out on Long Island that was operating at 1290 on the dial. That meant the people out on the island couldn't hear the 1280 station because the 1290 station was so much louder right beside it, you see. So they bought the station out and put it off the air. So the 1280 station could be heard then without any interference well out onto the island. Then some cooler head prevailed, at least for a while. I haven't been in New York now in several months, so I can't tell you exactly where this stands. But indeed, the 1290 station came back on the air, simulcasting, if you will, the programs of the 1280 station, which gave them even more reach out onto the island. And just where that stands today, whether the station is on or off, I don't know. Well, okay, we'll find out later, maybe. The FCC went on to say in its new rules that any one owner could buy as many as 30 AM stations if desired, and then could buy up interfering stations. And you see, they'd really clean up the AM band rather quickly if that happened. Well, it isn't going to happen quite that well. It took one member of the Congress to drop a note to the FCC chairman, I guess, suggesting that 30 was too many stations for any one person to own. So the limit now went back toward, it used to be 12, it's now 18. So any one person can now own 18 stations. And indeed, if you buy a station and put off the interference, buy a second station and put off the interference. And the way you do that is to, the first station you buy, you have to buy the interfering station or stations, since that might be two or three or four more stations right there. Kill those three, return the license, now you're back to one. You see how that works?
It works. That it means it cleans up the AM dial, and we get better DXing opportunities is really what it probably amounts to. So don't knock it too much. Well, the FCC went on to stipulate that it's not going to authorize any more daytime-only stations, as I mentioned. Lots of stations, as you know, in the U.S. right now have to sign off at local sunset. Because if they didn't, of course, their signals would cause interference to other stations hundreds of miles away at night. AM stations carry much further at night, as anyone can tell you who's heard stations from any one place in the country, you know, simultaneously from Boston and Minneapolis and Atlanta and Denver. And that doesn't happen during the daytime, but it's at night that the stations' signals carry so much further. Now, that doesn't mean that existing daytimers have a real problem. They can continue. But in addition to that, the FCC is probably going to be in touch with a lot of existing daytime stations, urging them to move to one of the new 10 dial positions up above 1600. The FCC has completed an interference study of every AM station in the United States. It was done by computer. And what they found is now being translated into a list of many stations that will be offered the opportunity to move to one of the 10 new channels, starting at 1610 up to 1700 kilohertz. And in addition, the FCC will ask all stations that apply to move to the new channels to broadcast in stereo sound on AM. Now, this is a bag of worms, and it puts a lot of stations in a quandary, because, of course, there is, even today, no U.S. standard for AM broadcasting in stereo. You may recall several years ago, the FCC set up some comparative tests of five stereo systems, and after the tests, all but two of the systems were rejected. But those two systems are still in use by some stations to this very day. One of them was developed by Leonard Kahn. That's called the Kahn system. The other system developed by Motorola is called the Motorola system. The two systems are not compatible with each other. What I mean is a radio receiver designed to pick up stereo in the Kahn system will not provide stereo sound from a station transmitting the Motorola stereo signal, and vice versa. But, you know, with no standard, and if you're the station manager, which stereo system are you going to go with? And it's a horse race. The Japanese have decided they're going to go with the Motorola system throughout the whole country. So slowly, I think Motorola is starting to win out. There's 400-plus stations that use Motorola and fewer than 100 that are using the Kahn system. So anyway, if a station's to start broadcasting stereo, you know, nobody out there in the audience is going to appreciate it really anyhow, except a handful of people in this room with stereo AM radios. But they'll get the priority in their licensing procedures, the FCC says, if they do say they'll broadcast in stereo. And just where this whole stereo thing stands is hard to say because, you know, the November elections, and I refuse to get into a discussion of politics, but there seems to be a finite possibility that the Democrats will take over control of the White House in the November elections starting in January of 1993. And if that happens, it's going to put a lot of things into a cocked hat because the FCC by law, which has seven commissioners, by law, four of those commissioners must belong to the reigning party, if you will, which in this case is Republican. So there are four Republicans and three Democrats at the FCC commission staff right now, and the commissioners, I should say. And after November, should Mr. Clinton win the election, that would have to go to four Democrats and three Republicans. That means everything will come to a screeching halt while the new FCC commissioner gets up to speed and learns what's going on. Well, anyway, so we'll see what happens there. This group, that, by the way, called the National Radio Systems Committee, that found that AM interference was what is wrong with AM, and it just didn't sound as good, have also said that the AM stations should be transmitting a clean 10,000 hertz audio bandwidth with the idea of competing head-to-head with FM broadcasters. And so that, you know, for most AM stations, that's going to mean a lot of cleaning up of their audio and RF equipment to meet the new wideband standards and things like that. For those of you who can will be around, Fred Vobey will be giving a seminar later in today, and he has a demonstration of comparing the standard AM broadcast, the NRSC AM stereo signals, and FM stereo. and you'll find that it's a giant step to go from the standard present-day AM to the new NRSC AM stereo. In fact, it would take a trained listener to hear a difference between AM stereo and FM stereo once it's done right. So, anyway, there are going to be 117 channels in the new AM band, as we've said, from 540 up to 1700. 60 of them will be clear channels. That's really the same as today. 51, which I'll call regional channels, and 6 local channels, the same 6 local channels we have today, 1230, 1240, 1340, 1400, 1450, and 1490. They will still be limited to 1,000 watts day and night. The clear channels will have a 50,000-watt daytime power and a variety of powers permitted at night, depending upon interference. And the regional channels will be allowed any amount of power that they can defend without causing interference, except those 10 new channels. And as I mentioned before, there's 10,000 watts days and 1,000 watts at night. Now, the FCC is not yet accepting any applications to move to these new frequencies, and we expect that that will still be true 2, 3, 4 months from now. Who knows? But probably within 6 months, the FCC will start accepting applications, so you can start expecting to hear things about 1610 to 1700, certainly during 1993, I hope. Who knows? In fact, you may even see new towers being erected for some of these upper channel frequency stations, even towers on top of buildings downtown, because after all, they're all non-directional, and in some cities, it's probably best to have the transmitter right in the middle of town so that all the suburbs in all directions get equal coverage. So we may go back to that sort of thing. The FCC, of course, has no control over the quality of radio receivers, since there are no radio receivers manufactured in the United States anymore. They thought about having some importation limitations on radio so that they could say, no, your radio doesn't sound good enough, take it back and don't bring it back into the United States until you get it fixed. They decided, no, they wouldn't do that, and that's too bad. But what can I say? That's an editorial comment I perhaps shouldn't make. Well, anyway, that's the end of my story for today on the new AM broadcast rules that are now in effect. Of course, I haven't told you anything about when all AM and FM broadcasting may come to an end anyway. Oh, you're interested? Okay. We'll talk about that in the next seminar that starts in just a moment.
I'd like to thank you for coming to the 1992 National Radio Club Convention. My name is Fred Vobey, and I'm the editor of the National Radio Club's DX Audio Service, which is, for most parts, the Books for the Blind version of DX News Magazine. However, we do get into many, many different things and topics and have a lot of features and pieces that DX News doesn't have, so we're really kind of an entirety of our own, so to speak. We've heard John Bowker talk about some of the digital stuff and what's coming down the pike, and I thought I'd discuss a little bit about AM radio transmission technology and how it can sound and how it can be screwed up and how you can make it actually sound good. Now, I'm probably one of the only people in the club that actually owns an AM transmitter that I can experiment with. I have several transmitters manufactured by Low Power Broadcasting, which I use as test bases for our automation systems at Great Northern Broadcast Company. And with these transmitters, I can also play around with them and experiment around with the different modulation envelopes to just kind of see what happens and how you can modify and change the spectrum to provide a better quality AM signal. Now, in changing the spectrum, I'm not really doing a whole heck of a lot. It's just the principle in which I'm putting together the transmission. Now, probably one of the two biggest gripes I've got about AM radio is the two things which come to mind. Someone always will be bashing AM radio, saying it's no good. You know, it just can't it can't hold up to its FM counterpart. Well, to some point, that is true. However, I always looked at two major faults with AM radio. The first is programming. Many radio stations around are programmed with what I call the vaudeville technique. And, you know, vaudeville died, and it's because no one wanted to go to the show. It wasn't entertaining. And the same thing applies to AM radio. If you have something on the air
that people don't want to listen to. They're not going to listen to your station. It was like I was quoted on Media Network a while back, about a year ago. I was asked why AM radio has this decline. And basically the answer is, well, you got a station, say in a town that's programming Lithuanian folk songs, how many people are going to really listen to the station? It doesn't take any brain scientist to figure it out that you're not going to get a 70 share in an average U.S. city unless you have a very, very high Lithuanian population. So, you know, you got this thing with the programming, which sometimes does not come up to being even par, but you also have the technology and the transmission characteristics of the actual station, which cause a lot of problems as far as how the radio station sounds on the dial. Now, we've heard John Bowker allude to NRSC2, and that is something which a lot of AM broadcasters are poo-pooing, but I'll be honest with you, I think it has a lot of promise, and I don't really count the AM band as being dead, and especially if you're in a situation where you're in a an area, say a rural area, where an FM signal might have some problems. That AM signal has a tendency to be able to still poke out through the range over a vast lot of mileage. You know, I guess basically that the first thing that comes to mind is being out in North Dakota several months ago and being able to listen to stations hundreds of miles away, yet I couldn't really hear any FM stations. So I think AM radio does have a place. But, you know, when we're driving out, we heard stations that sounded good and stations that sounded bad. Now, why is this, you might ask? Well, unfortunately, AM radio does not have the luxury of FM, where the transmission technique is very simplified. Most AM stations feed out of their transmitter into a device which is known as a phaser. Now, this phaser is used to take the signal and divide it into several different transmission lines, which then feed several different tower sites. And the device, the phaser, is used to mold the signal so that the transmission is made into a particular service area, or perhaps maybe it's even to eliminate signal into a certain area. In other words, to protect a station. We all know of stations that, you know, you can see the towers, but you can't even hear the station. Well, that's because their signal is being changed to protect from interference to another station, or maybe just to provide more signal into a certain area. Now, as the signal goes into this phaser, what happens a lot of times is it's altered. The components which are used in a phaser can change or mold the way that the signal is actually transmitted. It might go out clean, but the phaser can have a tendency to gum it up a bit. And so can the towers. If the towers are not broadbanded enough to be able to handle the transmitted signal, then you have a lot of problems. I worked at a station many, many years ago, which was an AM station. It used a phaser, which was kind of shoddily put together. And the thing that we noticed right off the bat after the consultant signed the paper, took his check, and walked out the door was the fact that the station, you listened to it on the modulation monitor inside the station, which was sampled off the output of the transmitter. The audio sounded fantastic. However, you drove to the south and got about 6 or 7 miles away from the station, and the audio at some points sounded almost like sideband, and it was very shrill and very very hard to listen to. And it wasn't until months and months of technical study had been done on this antenna system did we find out that one tower was receiving a good quality signal, full bandwidth from 20 hertz all the way up to 10 kilohertz. Another tower was receiving only, say, 20 hertz to 3,000 hertz. And another tower is receiving something else. Well, as this all goes through and gets molded together, it really gets mucked up, and it just basically makes the station sound bad. Now, to make a station sound good, you have to take into account what the phaser is going to do, and you have to design a phasing system which will pass all the frequencies. So let's first assume that you have a phaser system which will pass all the frequencies completely with no distortion added to the signal. And let's suppose that the AM signal, or I should say the AM tower, is not going to deter from the AM signal in any way, okay? Let's just give you a little bit of a sample of some audio right off one of our transmitters here. And this is going to be standard AM. This is what you have probably listened to for the last 20, 30 years or so on the AM dial. I'm just taking the audio out of our automation system and being able to put it into the transmitter. And then you're going to hear it coming off a Sony ICF 2010 radio as it's being transmitted. Now, the selection which I'm going to use is a selection by Philip Bailey called Easy Lover. And the reason I'm going to use this is because it has a lot of dynamics in the audio. And let's just set the benchmark for what an AM, a typical AM radio station sounds like. Okay? Here's Philip Bailey. Let's add something which is relatively new on the AM transmission market, and that is NRSC2. Now, what NRSC2 is, it's a processing scheme where the AM audio, the audio fed to the transmitter, is taken and shaped before it goes into the transmitter, and certain components are removed from it. Frequencies above 10 kilohertz. Now, this is done so that when you're transmitting the signal, of course, everyone knows that the adjacent frequency, you know, you go, say, 1240, 1250, 1260, 1270, it's 10 kilohertz spacing. And the reason that you want to filter out everything above 10 kilohertz is so you do not cause splatter to the station on the adjacent frequency. Now, also in NRSC2, what they do is put a slight preemphasis into the signal. And this is done to be able to mold or shape the signal prior to it getting lopped off there at 10 kilohertz. And I think you're going to notice a little bit of a difference in the way this station sounds. Now, here's that same selection played through the same radio. We're receiving it the same way, except this is NRSC2. Now, I might have some skeptics out there in the audience that say, well, AM radio still doesn't sound as good as FM radio. Well, we're going to see if we can perhaps remove some of the skeptics. Now, what we're going to do is take this same selection and play it through our NRSC2 transmitter, and we're going to take and play this into our FM transmitter at the same time. Now, we're not going to audio process this selection at all, because we don't want anyone to say, well, you added a little bit more processing on the AM than you did the FM, but you boosted this, the highs, or you changed the lows. We're not going to do anything. We're just going to keep it exactly the same. Same selection, splitting off, Y-ing into two different transmitters, one AM, one FM. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to have a beep tone, which sounds something like this. And when you hear that beep tone, that is the point where I'm switching between the two receivers. I'm going from the AM side, or I should say the two transmitters. I'm going from the AM side to the FM side simply by pushing the AM-FM button on the Sony ICF 2010. Let's give a listen and see if you can figure out which one is the NRSC2 transmitter. in case we still have some skeptics out there, I'm going to use another selection which has completely different dynamics. Listen again to NRSC2 and Standard FM. Okay, now I probably have some people wondering which one is the AM and which one is the FM. So let me start that selection back up again, and I will tell you as you listen to it, and let's see if you can figure out which one's which. And that's the one signal. Here's the other in 3, 2, 1. Changing. 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 Okay, which one is which? Well, the answer is, this is FM. This is AM. FM. AM. FM. AM. Do you notice that there's a little bit of high increase in the audio quality? Well, that's because of the NRSC2. Now, you might just wonder for a second, how that actually sounds when it's going into the system. Well, you ready for this? We're going to reach back here. We're going to turn off what's called the NRSC2 decoders, which are used prior to going into the transmitter. And here's how NRSC2 sounds as it's going into the transmitter prior to being limited. Okay, that's the compressed and also the molded signal. And as it comes back out the receiver, it sounds like this. And again, let's go to the difference. AM, FM, AM, FM. And as you can see, there is a little bit of difference in the audio quality. Now, I guess that blows out the theory that AM does not sound good. Now, albeit there is another component here that a lot of us have not taken into consideration, and that is the audio quality of the receiver. For many, many years, I've maintained that AM receivers are not really being built, you know, to the quality which they are supposed to be manufactured. And I guess the two things that really point this out are, first, a conversation I had with a Ford engineer back in 1982 when I purchased a vehicle, a Ford product. It was a Ford Fairlane. I asked the Ford people about why the radio in it just didn't sound as good as a lot of other radios. Well, the answer I got, and probably this guy got fired for saying this, but the answer I got is that they designed their radios in the cars so they cut off at 5 kilohertz. That way you don't really hear the ignition noise. Now, as many of you stand back there and moan and groan, that is a true statement. If you cut off the audio, you don't hear a lot of static. It's the same as if you're listening to your normal radio and you take and you turn down the treble control or take your tone control and, you know, make it more bassy. Of course, you're not going to be able to hear a lot of static. It's going to attenuate the sound of the static bursts and noise, which are prevalent on AM transmission. However, I just kind of think to myself that that's really not a good method for dealing with the interference. I mean, shouldn't they do something about the ignition system of the car rather than degrade the AM radio? I think so. And as far as, you know, the radios themselves not being able to receive good quality, let me point out a couple receivers which have been manufactured and sound very good. First of all is the Sony ICF-2010. Now, the audio sounds respectable coming off the speaker, but if you take the audio off of the output or the headphone jack and feed it into a stereo system, it actually sounds pretty good. Now, that radio usually it differs in different models, but it has audio response of somewhere between 7.5 and 10 kilohertz. And then in the narrow portion, it actually limits it down to around 3 kilohertz audio, or that related to like a telephone conversation. Another radio, which is I have always maintained is probably the best AM radio ever built since Sears Silvertone manufactured a model back in the mid-1930s. The radio is the Sony SRF-A100, and many of you know that radio as being the first AM stereo radio manufactured. It was kind of a long purse-looking type of radio. It held, as I recall, like six AA batteries, and it had a mode switch on it, which would switch between the Kahn system and the Motorola system. The FM was just simply terrible on the thing, which is kind of the reverse of what radios are today. But the AM was outstanding. And if you take and put that radio next to one of those antennas like John Bowker has, which is the select antenna, oh, the receiver just picks up beautifully and just makes a great, great sound. And probably the only other AM radio which has really come up to being a radio which passes the test for maintaining a high level of quality is a radio which was manufactured by a company called McKay-Dimeck. And McKay-Dimeck made many receivers back in the late 70s and early 80s, which were used as monitor receivers, primarily in radio stations, to pick up feeds off other radio stations and also for stations to use as off-air monitors. And these radios are simply fantastic. In fact, let's give you a quick demonstration of that. I'm going to take a tune to my local radio station here, and let's just give a listen. Okay, I have the volume up kind of high on my microphone so that you can hear me from back here. Here is a demonstration of how the different modes of sound. Okay, that's narrowband AM. And that's wideband AM. Okay, now we're back to narrow, like you're normally hearing it. And that's wideband. Now, the thing is, you have to keep in mind is that radio station that we were just listening to is also processing their audio, which is why it sounds a little shriller, but gives you an idea of what is actually out there. I mean, that's an actual McKay-Dimeck radio in the narrow band mode, which is what we're always listening to most of the time on our DX receivers and everything. And then you heard the wideband, which is what is actually being transmitted, what you're capable of hearing, if your receiver will receive all those frequencies. So anyways, there's a little demonstration of how AM can sound and also of NRSC2. John Bowker is going to be back in just a moment, and he's going to be talking about some other topics of interest. And we also have Skip Dabblestein, who's going to be talking about beverage antennas, and I'm sure you're going to want to listen for that. Again, thanks for coming to the 1992 National Radio Club Convention, and we hope to see you next year in Enfield, Connecticut, otherwise known as Hartford, Connecticut, for the 1993 National Radio Club Convention. 73s and good DX to all of you. Bye-bye.